The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Hello, chaps. Another week of off-season podcasting. I had a long drive yesterday. I listened to the podcast from last week. Very good, very entertaining. Helped me pass an hour and a quarter.
How long was your drive?
8 hours.
8 hours.
So I listened to it 6 times.
Oh, dear.
I listened to it 6 times just so I could make sure that I didn't miss any of the mistakes.
Just so you could fully absorb this scurrilous Tom Pidcock rumour that I tried to spread and tried to send out into the ether and hasn't really gained much traction.
No, it hasn't. I mean, you did a good job of managing expectations with that, of underselling it in a way, unlike a certain member of our team several years ago when he announced that Geraint Thomas was going to BMC and it was a done deal. This was a softer launch for this rumour, Daniel, which might be why it hasn't gained the traction. But it was a very interesting rumour, joining all the dots. I like the no comment from Andrew McQuaid. That was fantastically done. And there was a lot, actually. I mean, the Tim Kerrison departures, another significant bit of news from last week.
Any intel
changes
on that
at Movistar
from you?
Not really, no. I did pick up, the only thing I picked up on my holiday was a sighting of Dave Brailsford in near Monaco, where he now lives, climbing the Col d'Aise very quickly indeed. He's moved to Monaco quite recently. Tim Kerrison lives in Monaco as well, but I was interested in the idea that he may pop up at Israel Startup Nation, because I also wondered whether he might go in to another sport. I mean, famously, he was on his way to sign with English cricket, was it? It was certainly a cricket job that he was on his way to from swimming when he got a call from Dave Brailsford and the people at Team Sky. So he's worked in swimming. He's worked in rowing as well, I think. He's worked in cycling. He may well fancy another sport. So it's a very hard act to follow this week with all that news last week. What have we got this week, Lionel?
Well, Richard, in part one, we're going to talk about Alex Dowsett's hour record attempt in Mexico. I'm sure, like me, you stayed up to watch that last night. I mean, it's only 10 o'clock here in the UK, but that's a late night for me these days. The news is that he didn't break Victor Campenaerts' record of 55.089 kilometres. He did ride 54.555 kilometres, and since the kind of resetting of the rules in around 2014, and which led to the rebirth in our record attempts, it's actually the second furthest attempt by a man, further than the Bradley Wiggins record in 2015, which actually broke Alex Dowsett's own previous record, but not quite as far as the recent Dan Bigham attempt, which of course was not ratified by the UCI. But we'll talk about the world hour record in part one. In part two, we'll talk about the 2022 Giro d'Italia. The Hungarian Grande Partenza has been confirmed. No opening time trial, which was the original plan for 2020. Instead, there's a hilltop finish on day one, and the time trial will be on the second day. So on paper, I think it looks more interesting than the original Hungarian plan, which of course was cancelled because of coronavirus in 2020. And in part three, I'll talk about my own little holiday, my weekend holiday to the Koppenberg Cross in Belgium. The rest of the news, speaking of the Giro, on Saturday there's a Giro d'Italia criterium in Dubai where Egan Bernal, Filippo Ganna, Peter Sagan and Elia Viviani are all due to ride. Very similar styles of rider there. They're all going head to head in a 30 lap criterium on a 2.1 kilometre circuit. I'm not sure if that will be televised, will it, Daniel? Might be able to watch it on the internet. Big stars there. But talking of Elia Viviani, he is going back to Ineos. He rode for Team Sky when they were Team Sky, of course, between 2015 and 2017. Then went to De Koninck, where he was very successful. less successful at Cofidis, had a bad season in 2020, didn't win a race, although obviously the season was truncated, wasn't it? He did get 7 wins this year, but all in smaller races. But Viviani going back to Team Ineos. Omar Fraile, who's been at Caja-Rural and Dimension Data before, having 4 seasons at Astana, is also going to Ineos, as is Ben Turner from Trinity Racing. And as we mentioned last week, the rumour that Roger Hammond was on the verge of agreeing to become part of the management team, that has now been confirmed, and so he will be at Team Ineos next year.
And Lionel, there was a 4th signing announced by Ineos last week. They sort of announced their new signings, or 4 new signings, in the style of a Giro d'Italia 2021 Giro d'Italia route presentation across a single day, sort of interspersed throughout the day. But the 4th rider was the German under 23 national road race champion, Kim Heiduk. Now, last week, Lionel, we talked a bit about changing emphasis, didn't we? Ineos Grenadiers and their sort of stage race prospects, and we talked about Pidcock, but it struck me that those 4 signings, they weren't necessarily in the sort of usual Ineos Grenadiers mold. Most of the time with Ineos's signings or their sort of recruitment campaign as a whole, there was a very clear, Grand Tour sort of bias or emphasis to it. And maybe those 4, I know it's only a small proportion of their roster for next year, maybe that indicates that they are sort of broadening their focus and objectives slightly, because there isn't the sort of template of the Ineos Grenadiers mountain workhorse, or the sort of the identikit among those 4, really. I mean, Omar Fraile would be the closest, I suppose.
That's true, yeah. On with the news, Oleg Tinkoff, remember him, the owner of the Tinkoff team, and then Saxa Bank. He had Alberto Contador, Peter Sagan on the team at various points. He was convicted of tax fraud in the US and has been given a suspended 1-year jail sentence and a huge fine. Well, $250 million he's had to pay in unpaid taxes, and on top of that, another $250 million in a fine. Reports from the US put Tinkoff's wealth at about $2 billion, so probably has enough to cover that. This case centres on him falsely declaring his income around about 2013-2014. A costly episode for Tinkoff there. Basically declared his earnings as around $200,000 in a year when he disposed of almost £1 billion worth of property, if my reading of this case is correct. That's certainly what the tax authorities in the US
think. He's a naughty, naughty boy, isn't he?
Indeed, $250 million or $500 million would pay for quite a big cycling team, wouldn't it? But probably Tinkoff may stick to just trolling Jonathan Vaughters about wine from now on. I don't know.
Well, by all accounts, in spite of some real personal adversity, he's been suffering, I'm not sure where he's at with his leukemia, but he was treated for leukemia a couple of years ago, wasn't he? And I think he's making a recovery from that. But by all accounts, he's got richer and done relatively well financially, and well, until this conviction, since leaving cycling. That was what I read over the last few days.
He did always say he'd be back, didn't he, to win the Tour de France. And he also, there were rumours, I think they were scurrilous rumours, that he was stepping in when Sky announced that they were pulling out at the end of 2018. It was rumored that Tinkoff had contacted Dave Brailsford to offer to take over the team. Not sure if that was actually true, but I'm quite surprised at the leniency of the sentence given the scale of the crime, because in America especially it can be quite punitive if you defraud the authorities of that much money. I'm surprised it's not a longer jail sentence. Perhaps his health issues were taken into consideration.
Indeed. Last week we talked a lot about Quebecca Next Hash and their search for a sponsor for the World Tour team. Didn't mention that the Quebecca development squad will actually continue at continental level next season. We also talked about the 22 Italian track bikes, which were said to be worth around €600,000, that had been stolen from the hotel where they were staying for the World Track Championships near Lille in northern France. The championships were in Roubaix, of course. They've been found, not on eBay, as I suggested, but in a Romanian anti-drug raid. So those bikes will presumably be reunited with the Italian Federation. A few other little snippets. Vincenzo Nibali, who is returning to Astana, of course, he is planning to ride all five monuments in 2022. The world champion Julian Alaphilippe says that he will switch his spring focus to the Ardennes races, specifically Liège-Bastogne-Liège, rather than trying to do the Tour of Flanders and Liège-Bastogne-Liège at full pelt. He thinks that the gap between them makes it difficult to be 100% for both races, so he's going to focus on the Ardennes. And next week, it's the Ghent 6. Mark Cavendish is riding it again with Ghent's home star, Ilio Kaiser. They'll be up against the World and Olympic Madison champions, Michael Mercou and Lasse Norman Hansen. But on with the podcast, and in part one, we'll stick with the track and Alex Dowsett's World Hour record.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thanks very much indeed to Super Sapiens, title sponsor to the Cycling Podcast, for their support of the podcast. And I'm delighted to finally announce our competition winners. And we ran a competition during the Tour de France and the Vuelta and the Giro as well, in fact. And we did announce earlier three competition winners from the Giro. We've selected four winners from the entries we received during the Tour and the Vuelta. They will each receive 3 months worth of the Super Sapiens devices to monitor their blood glucose levels and help them in whatever goals they are aiming for. And the four who we've selected all had quite different and interesting ambitions and reasons for wanting to try Super Sapiens. So we're very interested to hear from them about how they get on. But the winners, who've now all received notification, and in some cases have received their Super Sapiens devices, are Nicola Hogan, Jane Lockett, who actually entered the competition on behalf of her husband, Ed, Carl Kuma, and Konstantin von Rundstedt. So well done to them. We were very taken by their submissions, their reasons for wanting to try Super Sapiens. There were lots of other good entries as well, and it was a very, very hard decision. We selected quite a long shortlist, and it's been a long process to decide the winners, and apologies for the delay, but we're looking forward to hearing how Nicola, Ed, Carl and Konstantin get on with their Super Sapiens. Well done to all of them. Well, on with this week's podcast. And Alex Dowsett last night had a go at the Hour record. He's held it before, of course, and I read in some interviews before this attempt that there was still some lingering frustration that he hadn't got more out on that occasion, that he could have made it harder for Bradley Wiggins, who subsequently went for the record and broke it. And I think this effort, from what I could tell, was obviously about raising awareness of haemophilia, a condition that he suffered from childhood, but also about that unfinished business, I suppose. It was about emptying the tank and seeing what he could do without holding anything back. He did fall just short of the record set by Victor Campenaerts a few years ago. But I think he's come out of this with a lot of credit and a lot of respect and admiration for the charitable aspect to it, the raising awareness of haemophilia. And there was a very touching interview with his parents, actually, which was broadcast as part of the show last night, where they talked about him as a young child dealing with haemophilia and how at that time, and I've spoken to him about this before, you know, they thought that sport was going to be out the question for him. So it's quite remarkable that he has enjoyed a very successful career as a professional cyclist. His mother talked about cutting the shoulder pads out of her dresses and jackets. Remember, shoulder pads were very fashionable in the days of Dallas and Dynasty back then. And she talked about cutting those out of her outfits in order to make knee pads for him to avoid the bruising and the risk of bleeding that could be so catastrophic for him as a haemophiliac. So a very, a successful career, a successful effort, even if he did fall short of the record. And it's a fascinating thing to watch, isn't it, Lionel? I don't want to say slow motion, but it's a very controlled effort. And Victor Campenaerts also spoke about how enjoyable the first sort of 15, 20 minutes are when you're riding at a pace that at that point in the hour is quite sustainable and manageable. And, you know, you never, it's not like any other event where you just, it's a man slowly drowning. You know, you're watching him slowly struggling to maintain that pace. And it was certainly very obvious towards the end last night how much the effort was telling on Dowsett.
Yeah, I mean, the speculation midway through when the time was, because it was being expressed in terms of the number of seconds down on the record, or the target pace he was, there's a sense that, oh, well, maybe can pull that round in the last 15 or 20 minutes. But I think that, you know, that's pretty difficult to do, as we saw as the clock went further against Dowsett and the gap opened up. And then once it was sort of, you know, half a lap's distance and then edging up towards a lap's distance, you know, a lap being around about 16 and a bit seconds, you know, that's a big old gap to close. And, you know, after an hour's riding, to be only, you know, a little over 500 metres down on Campenaerts' record, you know, that's about as close as I think you can get without being, you know, actually on it, on the pace. So, you know, yeah, it was a really sort of brave attempt. And I think that the one thing that I've taken from talking to a few people who know Alex well, one being James Millard, who used to be a British pro rider with the Plowman Craven team and knows Alex well, just how much Dowsett has put together the team, together with Chanel, his partner. You know, they have assembled everything, coaching, he's done all the logistics, he's attracted all of the finance and sponsorship, part of it being from Pfizer, who manufacture the drugs that haemophiliacs rely upon to, you know, to stay healthy and live normal lives. And I think, yeah, there is the overriding message, but also on a sort of personal level, you know, putting together the whole thing, you know, applying for the visas for everybody, getting the flights booked. And, you know, it's been a marathon effort, with the hour of cycling at the end being almost certainly not an afterthought, because, of course, you know, he's trained very hard for it. Wouldn't have gone for it unless he thought he could do it. But, you know, so much more leading up to that actual hour of cycling on the track that you know, perhaps people didn't see or appreciate. But I think I've certainly got an awareness of just how much has gone into it. And I suppose the other sense is that the record was there. It is in touching distance. You know, he did come very, very close. He obviously went further than the distance Wiggins went when he took Dowsett's record in the first place back in 2015. But I suppose there's the looming sense that Filippo Ganna has got his eyes on the hour record. And perhaps there is a sense at the moment, maybe misplaced, I don't know, but he does seem like the one man most likely to perhaps, you know, kick the record into the long grass for a little bit. You know, he looks built for it. He's obviously, you know, a fantastic time trialist, arguably the best time trialist in the world. He's got the track craft. He's, you know, got medals on the track. And, you know, it does feel like this was an attempt by Dowsett just to make it that little bit harder for Filippo Ganna when he, I think we all expect him to make an attempt on it. When that will be, we don't know. But, yeah, it's sort of a last chance saloon, I guess, for Dowsett to reclaim the record that he had held relatively briefly a few years ago.
I think it was a validation in a sense of Victor Campenaerts' record. It's always difficult to know in real terms how good these records are. I mean, probably the perspective is slightly skewed by the way Campenaerts' career has gone since he broke our record. He's taken his focus away from time trials, and he's now the sort of guy who finishes between 15th and, you know, 30th place often in time trials, or he has been in the last year. So you kind of forget how good he was when he broke it. He was beating people. I think he won a time trial in Tirreno Adriatico where he beat, well, everyone. Tom Dumoulin, I think he beat Ganna, I think he beat Wout van Aert, and he really was the best around at that point. And, you know, Dowsett, you said, Lionel, he went close. I mean, just to sort of put in perspective how close it had been, or it was, Campanert's record, 55.089 kilometres an hour. And if you imagine that was a time trial over that distance, well, Dowsett would have lost 35 seconds. He would have finished 35 seconds down on Campanert's. You look at the best ever, what they call the best ever human effort, Tony Rominger's 55.291 in 1994, Dowsett would have been 49 seconds down if that had been a time trial. And, you know, if you think back to the sort of time gaps we were used to seeing in the long time trials in the Tour de France. I mean, the last times the Tour de France had really long time trials, 2012, the last one, I think it was over 53 kilometres. Wiggins beat Chris Froome, who was second by a minute and 16 seconds. And then, you know, you go down to fifth place and it's 2 minutes, 25 seconds down. And Tony Martin in 2014, that was another long time trial, 54 kilometres. He beat Tom Dumoulin by 1 minute, 39 seconds. So, you know, in terms of long efforts, around about hour efforts, to only finish 35 seconds down on the gold standard is a damn good effort.
Just a corrections corner there, Daniel. Uh-oh. I'm not going to correct your maths. I'm going to trust your maths despite your record with the Sivakov factor, yeah, when it comes to shocking. Calculating things.
Also the light years. Also the light years comment. Yeah. There's a few emails where I have done that. Yeah.
But the best human effort is not Rominger. It's Chris Boardman, isn't it? 56.375 at Manchester Velodrome in September 96, when in the old Superman style, which was subsequently banned as a position, and a lot of the equipment banned as well. Now, of course, the monocoque aero frame and even I think the wheels he rode are not permitted anymore. You know, that I think you're right. The Campanert's record of 55.089, you know, it's both close to Boardman's, you know, absolute outright technology assisted record of 56.375, but also, you know, light years away, isn't it? Because, as you say, the margins are, you know, they're both very close and, you know, gaping, aren't they? Because of the type of effort it is, as you were saying, Richard, it's that just gradual running out of
years.
Yeah, well, that was I'm just demonstrating that I know that you can express 1.6 kilometers or thereabouts as a fraction of a light year.
No, I mean, I think you're right though, Daniel, that it has brought kudos to Campanert's and his hour record at a time when he's moved on as a rider and is no longer one of the top time trialists. His focus has changed, but it has highlighted what a good record that is. And there's nothing wrong at all with riders going for a record and falling a bit short. That's it'd be boring if every time somebody stepped up they broke the record. This only creates, I think, more interest in the event and in this particular challenge, and there are no guarantees with that.
I must say, I got the sense from Dowsett watching his videos, which is another element, Lionel, you talked about how much he's managed to put together in terms of creating this production, and you know, there were great burdens in terms of everything he and his partner particularly had to organize, but also some advantages in the sense that he was able to use, you know, pretty much exactly the equipment he wanted to use. But one of the things he took on was documenting everything on his YouTube channel, and it was, you know, really well done. A lot of content about that, and went into a great detail about things like equipment and, you know, the way he trained for the hour record attempt. But I did get the sense watching those videos that he was Victor Campanert said in advance of the attempt that he thought it was 50-50. I thought that in his heart of hearts, Dowsett was maybe even a little bit more pessimistic than that.
Well, it was interesting as well. I just mentioned the interview with his parents. His father said that he was nearing the end of his career. He's got another year, hasn't he, next year with Israel Startup Nation. I wonder whether that will be Dowsett's final year as a pro. We wait to hear. But congratulations to Alex Dowsett, and congratulations to Lionel and me for getting through this segment without him doing his Alex Dowsett impression and me doing my Victor Campanert's impression. You've all been spared.
I think the Dowsett impression is exclusive for Friends of the Podcast, isn't it? Am I right? Is it in a Friends of the
That's
Podcast?
That's what you pay the episodes? Big bucks
yeah,
for.
Yeah, you'll have to sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com and then work out which episode that features in, because I'm certainly not drawing anyone's attention to it.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Beer 52, the world's largest beer club. Now, Christmas is just round the corner. I know it's a few weeks away still, but it's about time to start planning for the festive period. And what better way to get ready for Christmas than by ordering a case of craft beers, either for yourself or for a friend or family member who appreciates lots of different, delightful craft beers. You can get a free case from Beer 52, and at the moment, if you order, you can get two extra free beers. So that's a total of 10 free beers in a case. All you have to do is cover the postage costs of £5.95. And to do this, go to beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com/cycle. We'll put the details in the show notes. Now, I mentioned Beer 52 is a beer club, and each month members get sent a case with a different theme, and usually that theme focuses on a particular part of the world. The most recent case I received, all the beers were from Croatian breweries, and it was a real eye-opener for me because I just associated Croatia, I suppose, with lagery style beers, but the variety was delightful and surprising, and I found that to be the case every time a case of Beer 52 beers has arrived on the doorstep. Each case comes with a magazine and some snacks, and if you don't like dark beers or porters, which I tend not to, I choose the light option, so I'll only get light beers. You can pause or cancel your subscription anytime, and to sign up at the moment, just go to beer52.com/cycle, pay the £5.95 to get a case of free beers, and remember, you'll get two extra free beers this month, so that's 10 beers for the postage cost of £5.95. Cheers.
Just before we move on to the Giro, Lionel did mention Friends of the Podcast, and of course, just released is the interview with Lionel, introducing Lionel Burney, all 2 hours and 8 minutes of it. I could have listened to that, I guess, 3.5 times or so on my journey, but I opted not to do that. Daniel, you had it lined up on your jukebox last week. Did you have you managed to listen to that yet?
No, saving it.
I hope the answer is yes.
I'm glad the answer's no. Let's move on.
Well, we look forward to your review. But it's getting a great response, a fantastic reaction from people who've really related to it, I think.
I did see, I have been enjoying the comments, the reviews, pretty much all sparkling, I think. But there was some comment, Lionel, about this being...
Well, Lionel's got a big family.
Definitive proof, definitive sort of verification of your credentials, the ultimate Englishman.
Yeah, baffling. Maybe, I was talking to Orla on Zoom. I was wearing a bowler hat. Maybe that's the reference. I don't know.
Cross of St. George fluttering in the background. Anyway, sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Eating a pork pie, were you, Lionel?
Yeah, well, I would. I probably was back then, yeah.
Back then. In the pork pie days. Anyway, that's available, Friends of the Podcast. Lots more coming up for Friends of the Podcast as well.
Maybe that should have been the subtitle, and Lionel Burney, the pork pie years. setting up a sequel.
If you want to sign up as a Friend of the Podcast, the price is frozen at £15 up to December the 1st. It will go up to £20 from December the 1st. So if you're a new friend of the podcast and you sign up before December the 1st, you can do so for £15. That gains you a year's access to all the new episodes that we release over the next year, but also the very, very sizable now back catalogue. The archive is all there for you.
Renewals, though, will renew at the original price or the £15, won't they?
Oh, what a bargain. So, unbelievable. Yeah. We're giving these away. Giving away this content. Anyway, on with the Giro. So the Giro this year, there's no big reveal. We all watched the Tour de France presentation a few weeks ago, held to great fanfare in a packed auditorium. It really is a presentation of the entire route of the Tour de France. And you get a sense that it's a whole thing. The Giro is doing it in bits, as if they're revealing the picture in fragments, and we've so far had, well, the Grande Partenza, as you say, Lionel, in Hungary. It's funny because I feel like we've already done it, having done our Giro. I feel like we've kind of done Hungary already, but we haven't, of course. And the stages, the two first stages that will start on the Friday are very interesting, I think. The hilltop finish on Friday's first road stage, followed by the 9 kilometer time trial the following day. I'm sure that's happened before, but I can't remember it happening. If anybody remembers or knows when that's happened in a Grand Tour before, please let us know. But what do you make, Daniel, first of all, of these first stages and of this method that Giro's using to reveal the route in stages?
Well, I'd echo you, Rich. The first stage in particular looks interesting, this hilltop finish. I mean, in the blurb that came out from RCS, the Giro organisers yesterday, they were calling it a sprint stage. It looks to me as though we might not get, certainly not a bunch sprint. It's more, if Primoz Roglic were minded to do the Giro d'Italia, it's ripe for Roglification. It's about 4 kilometre climb up to this place, intriguing place called Visegrad on the Danube. There's a castle which the race will climb up to. Did you know about Visegrad, the Visegrad 4? I did a bit of research on this yesterday. And the Visegrad 4 are basically Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic and Slovakia. They were, and they sort of got together after the fall of communism, these four countries, and they formed the Visegrad 4. And that where this happened, this sort of congress was at, was in the castle in Visegrad, and this was some sort of alliance to protect each other's or support each other politically and culturally. And this was a sort of nod to an agreement between more or less the same countries. It was Bohemia back then, but in the 14th century, also this sort of very important meeting that happened in the castle in Visegrad. So I've seen some of the pictures of the castle itself, and the location looks pretty spectacular. It looks a little bit like, Lionel, you'll be able to help me out here. What's the river that they climb up from in Flèche Wallonne? Is it the Meuse?
Yeah, that's right, Daniel. The river Meuse goes through or past Huy. That's right.
And they take, in the Mudahuy, it's a right turn, isn't it, onto the, in Flèche Wallonne, it's a right turn onto the Mudahuy. Here they'll be going along the Danube and then climbing up to the castle Visegrad. So that's going to be really interesting. And then the following day, the 9 point something kilometre time trial, which you chaps, well, you rode a simulation of that last year, didn't you? In our Giro.
Did indeed. I can confirm it was tough.
with a little kicker to finish that as well.
Quite a considerable kicker, yeah, at the finish, actually, on the simulation we did, yeah. But it will be interesting, that, won't it, with the not having the time trial on the opening day, but still having a time trial as part of the opening weekend. Like you say, Richard, I'm sure this sort of thing has happened in the Grand Tours before, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. I mean, it used to be fairly common for the Tour de France to have a team time trial, perhaps on the second day, back in the day of split stages, where they'd have a morning stage and an afternoon stage, maybe a team time trial in the morning and then a road stage in the afternoon, or the other way around. But yeah, just mixing it up and making it slightly different, it will inject a bit of life into the time trial as far as the GC goes, I think, rather than just having the stage winner automatically taking the pink jersey. If there are splits on the first stage, on the run up to the finish, and time gaps, it could make that that time trial, the not prologue time trial, really interesting and add an extra dimension to it.
Yeah, it adds a lot of interest to that time trial, because we'll have our calculators out working out, you know, who's going to take the pink jersey. But also, of course, there will be a rider in the pink jersey. There will be a race leader who will go off last. And I think all of that as well will make that time trial far more interesting than had it been the opener. So looking forward to that.
Another thing, chaps, I noticed yesterday doing a bit of reading about Hungary and what the start is likely to be like, the Grande Partenza. It should more or less coincide, because the date hasn't been set exactly, with a general election in Hungary, and that's part of the world where the politics have generated, where they've grabbed a lot of people's attention elsewhere in Europe over the last few years because they've got a pretty far right leader in Orban, the leader there. And, he's frequently in the news, in the headlines for what's fairly unpalatable views about the LGBT rights and also Hungary's position vis-a-vis the EU. And, yeah, that will be interesting.
But what about this business of unveiling the route in stages? I mean, as you said earlier, before we started recording, Daniel, a lot of the route has been pieced together online by super sleuths who have gathered information and more or less put the whole Giro route together. So those who are minded to search it out will know more or less what's in store. But they're unveiling the stages basically over the course of a week, aren't they? And
I mean, this is
a little bit at a time.
This is the Giro's grid start moment, isn't it?
I mean, I must admit, I don't want to repeat myself, and I mean, I just don't seek out the rumours until the tour route is announced, or the Giro route in this case is announced. I like to see it be unfolded in front of me and just, you know, build the anticipation. Oh, it's going here, it's going there. I suppose the only way that they could have announced it in stages with a bit more intrigue, perhaps like an advent calendar, do it over 3 weeks, one stage per day with a sort of social media fanfare, might have had a bit more impact or than doing it in blocks. But yeah, I don't know. It seems to rob it of being able to, you know, get the map and look at it and see the whole thing as a sum of its parts, which is what a Grand Tour is. It kind of in isolation doesn't really mean anything to me until you see the whole thing set out.
I believe there's a sort of ulterior reason for this happening, for this decision having been taken, and that is something to do with TV rights and the deal with Rai, so the state television network in Italy for the next few years, not having been firmed up yet. So there was a question mark about how or when or by whom the presentation could be broadcast, and consequently they've decided to do it all really using their own channels and social media. But this reflects something we've talked about and we've all noticed over the last few years, which is the Giro's it's sort of keenness to embrace new markets and an Anglophile market and a more of a sort of 21st century tech savvy market, using things like social media. Sometimes it's worked, sometimes it's come across, frankly, as being a bit desperate and a bit of an erosion of some of the things we love about the Giro. You know, last year, the cartographer, the guy who'd been drawing maps for the Giro, did draw maps for the Giro for decades, Cesare Sangalli, died in the last few months. And you know, even when he'd stopped working for the Giro, his legacy was continued with these beautiful maps that the Giro has always produced. And the ones they're currently producing, I would suggest, are not nearly as easy on the eye. And the Giro is always, it seems to me, stuck in limbo between kind of embracing the future and sort of leveraging its past, which is what a lot of us cherish about the Giro. And as regards the presentation, I mean, I, like probably you guys as well, have very fond memories of some, well, in my case, I suppose, Giro presentations of the past, which were, you know, I've attended some in, you know, big famous theatres, venues in Milan and in particular, and there'd be sort of a guest of honour who would help to unveil the stages, and often, you know, in Rai TV's case, there would be little reportages from, you know, mountaintop finishes in the dead of sort of winter, and you'd have people like Claudio Chiappucci riding up this deserted climb in somewhere in Campania in the south of Italy, and you know, he would be sort of introducing what was going to be one of the high points of the coming year's Giro to the audience. And you know, these were, from my point of view, maybe if I watched them back now they'd seem a bit naff, but from my point of view at the time, they were these great sort of televisual occasions. And you know, the way the Grande Partenza has been announced and the way these other stages are going to be announced this week seems to me a bit of a far cry from that, unfortunately.
And, you know, even if social media is robbing the organizers of some of the suspense and intrigue and mystery around the route, there's still, when the Tour de France comes to reveal the route in its entirety, there's still magic in that, in seeing the whole thing joined together. And there are some stages that are, you know, perhaps quite a hard sell, you know, a flat 250-kilometer stage of the kind that might be won by Dylan Groenewegen, for example. But the as part of the whole, it doesn't really matter. And I think it is a shame to break it up like that. But we go, I mean, it will be fascinating. We knew to expect Hungary as the venue for the start, and it will be a fascinating few days there. It's also interesting that it's a country, well, they've got riders now, and one of their riders, Attila Valta, had the pink jersey, of course, last year. But it's not a country with a great cycling history, and we covered this in our Giro. And there are other countries in the area, you know, Slovenia now, but Poland as well, who you think one day might eye a start of a Grand Tour. It's kind of surprising that Hungary is first of those.
Yeah, I should have mentioned. Did I mention that Poland were one of the Visegrad Four, or are one of the Visegrad Four? Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, and Slovakia.
And you mentioned the cartographer, Daniel. Sorry to change the subject here a little bit, but I'm going back to last week's episode. You mentioned Cesare Benedetti last week, having not finished the Italian Road Race Championship, one of the few races, or maybe the only race, he didn't finish this year. That must have been just before he changed to become a Pole. And I wonder what would have happened had he won the Italian National Championship and then become a Pole.
Good question. Would he have been able to become?
Maybe that's why he pulled out. He was worried about winning it. Back to the Giro, though. We go from Hungary down to Sicily.
That reminds me, actually, Rich, as you say that, I'm just thinking, didn't Andrei Chmiel ride for five different nations in the course of his career? Moldova, Ukraine, Russia, Belgium, and I think there was one other, and the Soviet Union.
Yeah. But we go to Sicily, which is similar to 2018 when the Giro started in Israel and then picked up in Sicily. That necessitates a rest day early on, as we'll have at the Tour this year as well. But what can we expect, Daniel, do you know, over the next few days, initially the Sicilian stages and as we head up Italy?
Well, this is another unfortunate facet of route presentations now, that whoever is minded to search out the rumours and there are Twitter feeds that are almost dedicated to really unwrapping the Christmas presents before Christmas morning. And we pretty much know what the route is going to be. And I'm just sort of looking at the rumoured route now. Some of the highlights, there's a return to Blockhouse midway through the race. So the Blockhouse is the climb made famous really by a couple of Giri featuring Eddie Merckx in the 1960s and 70s. But we're not going to go to the summit in 2022. There'll be a finish at the Rifugio Mamarosa, which is near the top, but not quite at the top. And Rich, there'll be a big stage in the Dolomites, as we expect, which will probably be the penultimate stage and maybe the decisive stage. There's going to be an ascent of the Mortirolo at some point. We don't know whether it's going to be from the hard side or the slightly more benign side. And it looks a fairly traditional route with Alps, Dolomites, some hilly stages in central Italy, and a finale in Verona, finish in Verona, and possibly a time trial. We've seen that a few times. Well, we saw the very famous time trial in 1984 when Francesco Moser beat Laurent Fignon in the time trial to Verona. We saw it 2010 as well when Ivan Basso won, when Carapaz won a couple of years ago. So, yeah, that's what we talked, didn't we, a couple of weeks ago about Grand Tours finishing in, outside or away from maybe their most traditional destination, which in the Giro's case is Milan, but we've had a few finishes in Verona, and we sort of agreed that we quite liked that, didn't we?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast and all our spin-off shows. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, enter the code SISCP25.
I've just written that down.
SISCP25.
I've just written that down because I actually need some Science and Sport products. I'm going to use that code. What was it again, Rich? SIS?
Just rewind 15 seconds, Daniel, and then you'll hear it. SISCP25.
I've actually written it down.
Lionel's taste test will return next week. I recently ordered some Science Support products here in France, Daniel, so I can confirm that having them delivered in the EU is not a problem at all. I took a big consignment to see me through the winter months. I mentioned that Science and Sport support all our spin-off shows. One of those is Explore, and it has returned for a mini-series throughout November. I think we're going to have 4 episodes. This first one sees Lionel and I tackle the pavé of Paris-Roubaix, and it also covers my week in the Veneto region riding the gravel there as part of Filippo Pozzato's week of racing and riding the gravel and doing the Gran Fondo. So that's all in
riding the dreamland.
Riding the dreamland. Yeah. That's the tagline. And next week it'll be Mark Beaumont's audio diary from GB Duro. And the week after that will be Adam Bowie's diary riding the King Alfred's Way. Adam is one of our producers, and that's a remarkable story that he tells about his own journey that he's been on the last year or so. So really great listen. And given that he's one of our producers, it's probably one of the best recorded episodes we've ever produced. It sounds great. He knows what he's doing. It sounds excellent. So do tune into that in a couple of weeks. We're introducing a new feature now, aren't we? We're calling this Show and Tell. This is Daniel's idea. She's stolen it from somewhere else.
I've stolen it from the Rich Roll podcast.
Okay. But it also kind of ties in with Lionel special, which is a lot about your formative years, Lionel, growing up and developing a love for football, cycling. So this is a bit like, being back at school and coming in after the holidays and telling us what you've been up to. What have you been up to in your holidays,
well,
Lionel?
Well, it is more what I got up to at the weekend rather than show and tell, because I haven't actually got anything to show from my weekend in Belgium. I went off to Belgium to the Koppenberg Cross, but I combined it with another of my interests, which is football. Don't all switch off in droves. There is actually a cycling link, because I went to the match between Zulte Waregem and Genk, and the final score ended up Zulte Waregem 2, Genk 6. So lots of goals
in
the game.
Who were the scorers, please, Lionel?
The scorers were all listed on the internet. I don't know off the top of my head who all the scorers were. I didn't recognise many of the players. Couldn't identify anyone who'd played in England, for example, that I'd seen before. Genk are going well, they're in the Europa League. They're actually playing West Ham
United.
Do
they play in purple?
Why not? They play in blue. They're a merger between two clubs, actually. Winterschlag and Wattershy merged in, I think, the late 80s or maybe the early 90s. And there was some dispute, I think, about it. Wasn't a terribly popular merger, but there are two teams in a town the size of Genk, and one played in red and black stripes, the other played in yellow. So they settled on blue as a sort of compromise.
Is this show and tell feature just an attempt to sneak in football by the back door? Is it going to be golf with Daniel next week?
No, well, the cycling link is that Zulte Waregem play in the Regenbogstadion. It's got a sponsor's name now, but the original name is the Regenbogstadion, which means Rainbow Stadium. And it was built for the 1957 World Cycling Road Race Championships, won by Rick van Steenbergen on the track. Obviously, no velodrome, no track inside the stadium now, but a little link there. And the Grand Prix E3 finishes right next door, doesn't it? So, yeah, right in the heart of West Flanders, this is cycling territory. You see all the signs for Brakel and Oudenaarde and Hellasbergen. And anyway, I went to the Koppenberg Cross, which was held on Monday, a public holiday in Belgium, All Saints Day. So big crowd of people out. The second big cyclocross race in as many days, because there'd been a World Cup event elsewhere in Belgium the day before. And although it isn't a World Cup event, it was the first round of the X2O Badkamers Trophy Series, which is a kind of second tier level of races for cyclocross. And of course, it takes place on the Koppenberg climb, famous from the Tour of Flanders. Everybody will know it. It's one of the steepest climbs that they tackle in the Tour of Flanders. It's where Jesper Skibbe came to grief many years ago in an edition of the Tour of Flanders, and his bike was run over by the lead commissaire's car, or the race director's car. And the race is basically a full gas sprint into the bottom of the climb, up the climb, and then, you know, snaking through the adjacent field and popping out not quite at the bottom of the climb, but sort of halfway up, and then climbing up again. And it was everything that Belgian cyclocross, you know, appeals to me, really. A big crowd of people in a muddy field, queuing for the beer tent, as they were. I wasn't, because I was driving home afterwards, but I did have some frites and mayonnaise. And while I was there, I spoke to Sven Nys, a nine-time winner of the Koppenberg Cross. He's won it more times than anyone else. The event was actually founded in 1988, and a women's race was added in 2002. But Sven Nys, who dominated cyclocross in Belgium for many years, is now working for Belgian TV. And of course, his son, Thibaut, is a rider, was on the podium in the under-23 race. But with Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert having gone head-to-head against each other so often in recent years in cyclocross, and now having mostly transferred all of those skills to the road, they are not racing in cyclocross at the moment. And I wanted to sort of take the temperature of where cyclocross stands at the moment. So I thought Sven Nys would be the man to ask. Well, Sven, here we are in Koppenberg, a race you won many times in your career, with Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel, such big stars on the road now. How is cyclocross in terms of its profile at the moment? What sort of place is the sport in at the moment?
It's on a really high level, and the whole cycling scene is watching cyclocross for the moment, because a lot of cyclocross riders are doing really well on the road, also the young guys now. And yeah, it's a discipline where you can learn all the skills, explosivity, the power, the intensity of 1 hour full racing, and use your technique and all those things together, makes that you can be also a really good road rider. So teams are interested now in bringing also athletes to their teams coming out of cyclocross. So it's an important step for us. And yeah, that's pretty interesting to see.
Do you think then we should be really watching the under 23 level, because there's some riders in there who already have some results on the road?
Yeah. For example, my own son, he was the European champion in Italy last August. So I think a lot of riders, not only in the men's category but also in the girls' category, doing a perfect combination. For example, Blanca Vas, she was fourth at the Olympics mountain bike. She done, I think, a podium or fourth place in Europeans under 23 on the road. Yeah, and now she's winning also yesterday a World Cup. So yeah, it's nice to see that that you can combine all those disciplines. But you need to be a complete athlete, otherwise it's not possible to win here, for example, on the Koppenberg, because it's a really hard race.
I mean, thinking back to your time, lots of people talked about the way you dominated cyclocross for so long. Why didn't you cross over to the road? And then Van Aert, Van der Poel, Tom Pidcock as well, you know, they seem to have bridged that gap. Is that because their style of racing suits the way road racing is now, or in a way has what they've done in cyclocross just transferred across, that explosivity into climbs, that 1 hour effort at such a high level? I mean, how can you explain it?
I think it was not the moment to be an athlete that combines all those things. Racing on the road was not the really nicest moment to race on the road. If you see what happened with all those athletes, and for me, I could use my technique, I could use my power in cyclocross, and I knew that if I would be also a really good road rider, I need to drop a lot of cyclocross races. And in my mind, I was a cyclocross rider. I want to race from the 1st of September until the last of February. I try to not only do good for myself, but also for the sport and let it grow. And I think now the younger generation, they can use that the sport growth and teams were not ready also to give riders the opportunity to combine. If you were a road rider, you need to race from February until the end of August. And now they can say, okay, no, you can race a few months and then recover and then go to cyclocross. And things are a little bit more easy than 15, 20 years ago.
And lastly, I mean, having the likes of Van Aert, Van der Poel at these races and at the World Cups obviously increased the profile of those events. Do you think we'll ever see them back in cyclocross, or do you think it's too hard to combine a full classic season, doing the Grand Tours, aiming for the World Championships, and doing cyclocross deep into the winter and through the winter?
I think the difficulty is the Tour de France, because riding in spring classics, combining with cyclocross, that's okay. And also the end of the season, and doing, for example, World Championships, maybe the Vuelta a few weeks. But also in that middle section where the Tour de France is, there is no recovery anymore. So, and then you need to drop a lot of cyclocross races, because otherwise the spring classics are coming really quick again. And it's all human beings that need to recover also after a while. And that's what you see now. I think in the past you saw them in the end of November, maybe half of November, but now we're going to see them later and later, because yeah, they raced until half of September, maybe at the end of September, and they need to recover. So I understand, but they have the passion for cyclocross, and they are going to come back, but maybe only the important month of January, go to World Championships, and then recover again for the Spring Classics.
And very lastly, who should we be looking out for? Because, I mean, Elie Isabeth does so well in the cyclocross races, but is not perhaps going to cross over. No. But the next Van Aert, the next Van der Poel, who are they going to be? If you had to pick two or three names.
It's not gonna be one guy who is riding in this peloton. I think the guy who is coming the closest when you talk about combining is Quinten Hermans. But then it needs to come from the younger generation. For example, the world champion Pim Ronnaert, maybe Thibaut Nes can do that. But for example, Elie and also Toon Aerts, Elie Isabeth, they're not going to do the combination of both disciplines and riding on a really, really high level on the road. But that's okay. They are 100% professional in cyclocross, and they do really well, and they're riding on a really high level.
Well, Sven Nys there answering the key question, when we can expect to see Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert back in cyclocross events. And he seemed to think in January, but it looks like there's been a bit of news coming out of the Netherlands and Belgium that they will both be back a little bit before that. Van der Poel set to return in mid-December and build up towards the World Championships. Wout van Aert perhaps a little bit later. They may not face off against each other until after Christmas, but as Nys said there, the big problem isn't necessarily combining cyclocross and a classic season, or cyclocross and an end of season campaign. It's the fact that the Tour de France sort of, you know, sits in the middle of the year, and well, if they wanted to do everything, basically they wouldn't have any time off at all. So a slightly truncated cyclocross season for the big two, but it'd be good to see them back in the mud.
Lionel, did you introduce yourself to Sven Nys as the founder of his UK fan? Was it UK fan club or English fan club?
It was the UK branch of the fan club. No, funnily enough, I didn't do that. I thought, you know, that was so long ago now. And also, I wasn't sure that he'd be give any more than a sort of Belgian shrug and an, oh, good.
Any sense beyond that, Lionel, at the weekend of how business is for cyclocross? Because I remember in our short-lived venture into the world of cyclocross podcasting a couple of years ago, it was very clear how personality dependent cyclocross was, you know, in terms of, it's also kind of unique among cycling disciplines in that a huge part of the business model is gate receipts, effectively, you know, how much money is taken on the, in the turnstiles, as it were. And it was clear then that if Wout van Aert or Mathieu van der Poel was on the start list, then the gate receipts would be a lot healthier. Everyone would make a lot more money and business would boom. And obviously with COVID as well having affected cyclocross in the last couple of years, I just wondered, you know, have you got a sense of how things were going?
Well, I mean, I think at its peak, the Koppenberg Cross had had sort of 10 or 15,000 spectators in. It was difficult to know exactly how many people were in, but it wasn't as rammed as I've seen at other events in Belgium. But there was still a great atmosphere. But I think you're right. It's the big stars that draw in the big crowds. And, you know, no disrespect to Elie Isabit, who won the race and is dominating cyclocross at the moment. He's leading the World Cup quite handsomely at the moment. He's won the Koppenberg Cross 3 years in a row. His big kind of rival at the moment is Toon Arts, and they had a real kind of shoulder-to-shoulder battle for the first third of the men's race. But it's fair to say that they are the level down from Van der Poel and Van Aert. And of course, it's not only their brilliance in cyclocross, is it? It's the crossover to the road, which then, you know, feeds the interest in cyclocross. So I would say it was about par in terms of the crowd and the interest. And you obviously see the big groups of lads drinking beers, lots of people slipping over in the mud, because of course it's a very steep field, the one adjacent to the Koppenberg Cross. So there's sort of a grubby festival party type atmosphere. And midway through the men's race, there was an absolutely torrential downpour, and I have to say people were kind of slipping away at that point, not staying for the end of the race, perhaps wisely, because when I did head back to my car after the race, I was parked in the press parking in a grassy field, and had a real eggy few moments. Thought I was going to get stuck in there or need to be rescued by a farmer with a tractor. But in the end, I slip-slided my way down the hill and managed to steer my car through a gate next to some cows and onto some tarmac. And it was quite a relief to get out of that muddy field before all of the rest of the press pack had headed back. But I say, well, my sense was that cyclocross does miss Van Aert and Van der Poel, but the fact that they are going to be back will obviously give it that extra impetus later on in the year.
And Pidcock.
And Pidcock also too, yeah.
I spoke to him, I mean, just as a bit of a coda to the scurrilous rumour about Bora Hansgrohe, when I spoke to him a few weeks ago at the World Championships about his goals for next year, he was pretty emphatic about the World Championships, the Mountain Bike World Championships being his biggest goal, I think
it was,
I remember.
It was slightly correctly. Suspicious though, when he responded to you in German, wasn't it, Daniel?
yeah. With a thick sort of southeastern kind of borderline Austrian accent. Yeah. I'm pretty sure he said the World Championships mountain bike were going to be his big goal, but he said that he would be riding some cyclocross in the new year as well. So I guess he'll be lining up against Van.
Well, just to sort of back up what I was saying, really, and also with a bit of a Pidcock link, the under 23 race was won by Pim Ronhart, a Dutch rider, the under 23 world champion. But Cameron Mason of Trinity Racing was,
yeah, I've been waiting for this.
Initially,
the Scottish element.
A little bit. There was a little bit of a gap, but Mason really closed it down over the last lap and a half, and was closing in on him on the finish, on the final climb up the Koppenberg on the cobbles. And of course, you know, Mason riding for Trinity Racing, which in its previous guise was Wiggins Pro Team, which Tom Pidcock rode for a couple of years. Thibaut Nice was third. Sven Nys's son, of course, and who's been getting some results on the road. And then there's definitely a sense of the importance of this crossover and everything linking back to the road riders. Because before I spoke to Cameron Mason, he was talking to one of our Belgian colleagues, and I don't want to exaggerate too much, but about the first five questions were about Tom Pidcock and whether you know, Mason had his eyes on following Pidcock onto the road, because it just all feeds into that, I think, for you know, the mainstream public and even the cycling press and public over in Belgium. But I spoke to Cameron Mason, who, Richard, is from Linlithgow in Scotland. Have I said that correctly? Between Edinburgh and Glasgow. And the venue for the West Clarion Cycle Circuit.
Is that near Hart Hill, Richard? Sounds like it might be near Hart Hill.
Well, not too far away, I guess. It's West Lothian. It's not a million miles away from your ancestral roots, Daniel.
But I think, isn't a corner at the new West Lothian cycle circuit going to be named after you, Richard?
Yes. No. I agreed to that too quickly. We raised money for the West Lothian cycle circuit a couple of years ago through the sales of cups, and I got an update on that very recently. Will we hear from Cameron Mason while I look up that update?
There's a bit of a power vacuum at the moment that Van Aert, Van Der Poel and Pidcock have kind of left. But, I mean, that means that the young up-and-coming riders, as we've seen the world champion winning here today, your result, I mean, talk about your weekend, because ninth in the Elite World Cup yesterday, I think it was, and second today on one of the most famous hills in Belgian cycling.
Yeah, I mean, to do this ride on this weekend with yesterday's famous race and today, like, yeah, it's probably, if I was to pick one weekend that I was to be 100%, it would be this weekend. And after last weekend in Zonhoven, where I rode 17th, I was like, it's a good start, and I know next weekend is only going to suit me better. So going into yesterday, I had a terrible start. I was like second to last into the first corner, and at that point I was thinking, let's just ride a recovery race. Let's just ride a time trial, pick off riders, and then three laps in I was already in the top 20. So it was just picking off riders, and I think I prefer to race from the back. I can see where all the riders are. When they make mistakes, I can just slide through, and on a course like yesterday, as soon as you force it, you make mistakes. So I was just trying to relax. It's the same today. If you fight the bike, you're just going to go backwards, because today, it felt like, even though it was 50 minutes long, it felt like one of the longest races ever. Every time you come to that climb and you know that it's one massive effort just to ride it, just to keep moving. And one time I unclipped halfway up the climb and I was like, I'm done. I had no idea how I was going to get going again. But yeah, I managed to clip in and keep riding to the top. But yeah, in the mud in Koppenberg, to even just finish is an achievement, I think.
How much of a run into the first climb do you get? Because it's already breaking up as soon as it hits the bottom of the climb.
Yeah, so on the first lap, there's a couple of hundred metres on tarmac, and then you hit the cobbles, and it just ramps. And then when you join where the course has come from the right, it's just all mud. So all the mud on the cobbles. So I think at that point I was 5th, 10th position, and already one guy had to get off and run. I could just hear behind me that the carnage. I was the last rider to get through, so I can't imagine running up there in, we all have toe studs on our shoes, and you just can't run. You're just like Bambi, running up wet cobbles. Although I can't imagine doing it in wet road cycling cleats. That's something different. But today, I think 5 times up that in the mud is tough.
Your specialty is more cyclocross mountain biking, or your preference maybe. How do you see the next 2-3 years of your career? What direction are you aiming in?
I don't know, I'm not very good at planning ahead. Normally I just kind of do what is fun in the moment. So for me, that's cyclocross, and I broke my arm quite badly in April, which meant that I couldn't race mountain bike all summer. So the reason I did more road racing was because I wasn't still, my arm is maybe 80-90% strong around the elbow. So yeah, the road racing opportunities I did take this year with national champs, it's opened my eyes up to that, because before I always thought I was too busy to try and do the road. And it's, as you know, it's so multifaceted, with tactics and all this and different type of parkers, whereas if you go to a mountain bike race, you do your job, you go 100% and then go home. Whereas I see road is a bit more complex in a good way, but then also a bad way, because you need to, the experiences. Yeah, I'm so bad at holding a wheel, and as soon as we go into the winds, I just get absolutely shoved in the gutter and those little things. But even in the 5 road races I've done already at national champs, I was top 30 in the finish, so it shows I can learn quickly. So maybe next year I would like to do some stage racing. I think that could really add to me as a rider, that depth and knowledge.
Is it also the different mental intensity of road racing? I mean, lots of periods of time where on the face of it not much is happening, but you've just got to be switched on and concentrated, but at a sort of lower intensity. It's not quite as, full on, as not much of a sensory experience as a cyclocross is, maybe.
Exactly. Like today, like I'm used to riding 100% all the time, basically. Like my heart rate is 190 beats like for the whole time, and it never recovers. Whereas in the bunch, in my first few races, I'd be riding along and it would be easy, but my heart rate would still be super high because I'm like looking around like, oh, like are there splits going, all this stuff. But what I need to learn is that you can just, sometimes you need to really relax and then sometimes you need to really turn it on. And it's that like polarized kind of racing that I think I can, it suits me because of how on off the mountain bike and the cyclocross is, but mentally just learning to relax when you can relax and then really go hard when you need to.
Does seeing the Koppenberg and riding a bit around this region, I mean, does it open your eyes a bit to the history and the romance of the Tour of Flanders? I mean, this is just sort of, I don't know, the Hampden Park of European cycling in a way.
Yeah, so when I came to Belgium the first time a few years ago, I was like, within a week, I was like, I can see why there are strong riders around here, because it is grim. It is not a nice place to ride a bike. And, well, I mean, I only know it really in the winter, so I just can't see how, like, why is cycling the national sport here when the roads are so terrible sometimes and the wind is so horrible? But yeah, it makes strong riders. You know how to ride in the wind and you know how to ride on the cobbles. Although I avoid them every single time when we're training, because we, like, if you see a cobbled road, you're like, nah, not today. We'll save that for the racing. And I think the pros do that as well. They must, like, if you ride past the Koppenberg on a training ride, like, why would you go up it, suffer up it? But yeah, like, we only do like a short section of the Koppenberg really today. We do the hardest bit. But to come into that, like, yeah, 190 deep, kilometers deep, wow, yeah. And then it's always the push on after, I think, as well, which is, yeah, we don't really have in the cyclocross. But yeah, imagine Alaphilippe at the front just like shoving it in the gutter in his big ring and just like doing a no, thank you.
Well, that was Cameron Mason there. I have to say the best race of the day was the women's race, a really close battle between Clara Honsinger of the USA, the American champion. She was the eventual winner, and Denise Betsema, who has been a feature in the World Cups so far this season. The race itself was renamed the Grand Prix Julien Verschuren after the 2015 and 16 winner, who died from a brain tumour in July, and there was a little presentation for her as well at the finish. But that was a really good race. It probably had the worst of the conditions, really, because there's all the junior races, the under 23 race. The cobbles were extremely muddy by that stage, and then by the time the men started racing, the rain had washed a little bit of the surface mud off. But yeah, proper Belgian cyclocross conditions, and the frites and mayonnaise were very good as well. So all in all, a great little trip if people can make it over to one of the cyclocross events in Belgium or the Netherlands for a little trip, COVID restrictions notwithstanding. It's a really worthwhile thing to do if cyclocross is your thing.
During the World Championships in Belgium a few weeks ago, I did a bit of investigation as to why Belgians have this affinity for frites, for chips, and they claim to have invented them. Did you know this? And this goes back, we mentioned the Meuse River and Flesh Wallon earlier in the episode. Well, the story, one version of how chips were invented goes back a few centuries, and the story goes that one year the Meuse River froze over and the local inhabitants could no longer fry fish that they would take from the Meuse, so they started frying little batons of potato instead.
Wow.
Well. Speaking of inventing foodstuffs, something we forgot to mention in the news roundup was the very sad tiramisu news, Daniel.
Well, yes, the inventor of tiramisu. This podcast has covered the origins of tiramisu in some detail, and this dates back to our visit to Le Beccherie in Treviso, Lionel, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, the 2018 Giro d'Italia. Le Beccherie, run by the Campeol family, has been for generations, and they are widely credited with inventing tiramisu, although there is another location in Tolmezzo in Friuli, which also lays claim to having invented tiramisu. But the Campeol family, unfortunately, is grieving this week because Ado Campeol, the inventor himself, of Tiramisu died a few days ago. He was 93 years old, and as we mentioned at the time, it's actually quite a recent invention. This, it supposedly goes back to, I think, the 1960s, and Ador one day was trying to make some ice cream, vanilla ice cream, and some mascarpone ended up, finding itself into the mix, and he froze the resulting mixture, and tiramisu was born. He sort of experimented with some cacao powder, and as covered by us famously at the timeline, no alcohol in tiramisu. A lot of people think there should be, but there was none in the original recipe. We tasted it and it was fantastic, but no doubt Le Beccheria in Treviso will continue to serve tiramisu and continue Ado Campiol's legacy.
Well, if he lived to 93, it's a great advert for the health properties of tiramisu. I might go and get stuck into some a bit later on today as part of my healthy regime. I promise you a little update on the West Lothian cycle circuit, which we raised money for a couple of years ago. They just received a big boost. Matt Ball emailed to tell me they got £636,000 from Sports Scotland. So they've now raised £1.2 million and building work is projected to start in March 22, which is great news. So well done, very, very well done to them and everybody involved in that campaign. Slow Radio, chaps, it is the off-season. We're looking for your Slow Radio submissions. Email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Let's play one from our good friend Alistair Lloyd-Jones, who's been helping us a lot this year on the marketing and the social media side of the podcast. He was recently in Mallorca and sent us this. Thanks for that, Alistair. That was wonderful. Really transported me to a warm summer's day in Mallorca. And I think you were coming down Sawyer at the time when you recorded that. And thanks very much for all your help this year as well. It's been much appreciated. Any other business this week, chaps? I just wanted to mention quickly the Ghent Six, because that's another of your winter loves, Lionel. That returns next week. I gather it'll be a full audience. It's going to be pretty much as normal, the Ghent Six.
Corrections Corner, it's actually the following week, isn't it? It's the 15th. I'm racing ahead of myself there, Richard, earlier on in the news roundup. The Ghent Six actually starts on the 17th of November, runs until the 22nd, of course. But it's coming up soon. And that's another great trip to make. The little track there, the Kuipka track, is a tight, intimate venue. It'd be interesting to see. I mean, it's a sort of place that the atmosphere can get quite dense in there in the evenings when the track centre is packed in post-COVID times, it's not really post-COVID times, is it? We're still living through COVID. It will be interesting to see what sort of measures they have in place. They do say on their website that, like a lot of events, you have to be double vaccinated or have a certificate of recovery or a negative PCR test 2 days before going to the event. Certainly those things were checked when I went to the Belgian football match.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. It's always a great event. We'll return next week. Before that, we've also got another episode of the Cycling Podcast, Femina. That will come out probably Friday. It's had to be rejigged because there's been some exciting news concerning one of our presenters. You might be able to guess what it is. So it's a bit of a makeshift lineup for the Cycling Podcast Femina. We'll announce that exciting news in the episode, and should be out on Friday. If not Friday, then Saturday. And we'll return next week with another regular episode. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, chaps.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Will Jones.